It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how war and conflict has created a generation of displaced scientists and how some groups are trying to get their careers and research back on track.
First, the city of Chicago filed a lawsuit today against the Trump administration's Department of Justice for threatening to cut federal funding to sanctuary cities like Chicago.
The Trump administration has criticized sanctuary cities for not doing more to crack down on illegal immigration when undocumented immigrants are detained on charges that are unrelated to their immigration status. Sanctuary cities generally do not comply with federal requests to turn them over to immigration authorities for possible deportation.
Nadav Shoked is an associate professor and expert in local government law at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. Nadav, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how much power does the Federal Department of Justice have to cut various forms of federal funding to these so-called sanctuary cities?
Well, it always depends on what specific source of funding they're going after, and that's why the litigation we're seeing now here in Chicago is different from the one already, 4 months in Northern Cal. What's going on now in Chicago is that this very specific grant that the federal government awards to local governments for specific policing services has been threatened by the federal government, and the city claims that the Justice Department has no power to do that.
And this lawsuit from Chicago, it's just an announcement at this point, but what kind of grounds could the city use to challenge what the Department of Justice is threatening to do?
It's beyond the announcement. They actually filed a complaint based on the department's announcement. The grounds for Chicago's claim are varied, but the strongest one is the argument that what the administration is trying to do here is actually something that only Congress can do. So Congress created this specific grant, the Byrne grant, to cities and set specific criteria for the award of that grant. Specifically, those criteria have to do with the size of the state and the amount of violent crime taking place there. That statute, so the city claims, leaves no discretion to the administration, to the Justice Department, for imposing new conditions as they are now. Basically, these conditions that requires the city to help the federal government in finding, basically, illegal immigrants.
Do we see this kind of issue often where the federal government tries to put strings on federal funding to kind of leverage cooperative behavior from a local or a state government?
Well, that's a good point. And indeed, we find those things very often. The Supreme Court has again and again pretty much gave the federal government a blank check based on this idea that, yes, there are things that the federal government cannot do itself because in our system, a lot of powers are reserved to the state. So for example, the federal government cannot tell the state of Illinois or the city of Chicago how to run its schools. But it can condition the grant of money on such changes to Chicago or Illinois schooling policies. The famous case is a case from the 80s, whereby in order to get money for highways, states had to adjust their minimum drinking age, push it up to 21, that is. And the Supreme Court said that's fine, as long as there's some connection between highways and people drinking, and there is, you can do it. So the same applies here. The federal government can condition money it grants to the Chicago police or to the San Francisco police on the Chicago police or San Francisco police doing something. The argument here is that the federal government has not really done it because Congress, who's the one who has the power to do it, did not do it.
Nadav Shoked is with us from Northwestern University, the School of Law. They are looking at this lawsuit from the city of Chicago targeting the Department of Justice. That federal department wants to cut off certain kinds of federal funding for Chicago for being a so-called a sanctuary committee dealing with illegal immigration. Let's give a listen to Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel talking about the decision to file this lawsuit. He was talking on the radio show Connected to Chicago.
We're not going to actually auction off our values as a city. So on Monday morning, the city of Chicago is going to the court and take the Justice Department to court based on this. We find it unlawful and unconstitutional to be, as a city, coerced on a policy.
So unconstitutionally, says, to be coerced on this policy by the threat to cut off funding. From what you said about the U.S. Supreme Court, that idea that this is unconstitutional might not hold water.
Well, it would not hold water had Congress done this. But Congress did not do this. The Justice Department itself, that is to say the executive, did it. There's hardly any doubt that Congress could enact a statute, could change this specific law to say that you can only apply and get these funds from this specific burn grant. You can only apply and get it if you collaborate with the immigration authorities. But Congress did not do that. So Chicago's claim here, at the end of the day, when you look at what's the real claim in the lawsuit, it's not so much this idea of the federal intervention in state or local government affairs as it is this idea of the administration intruding on the territory of Congress, the administration adding conditions to a law that Congress has enacted without those conditions. And that is actually a very strong argument.
Now, there are different definitions out there of what a sanctuary city is, but looking at this particular case, Nadav, would a ruling in this case affect other cities, other states around the country?
Well, that's a fair question. To a great extent, it has to do with the money involved. That is to say, so say that the city loses this case. What happens there? Well, the city then has two options, either abide by the requirement that the administration is now making, which are specifically to allow federal agents access to the city's detention centers, and also to give the administration notice before they release any alien. So that's option one, just abide by it and take the money. Option two is just say, I'm not doing this, but then I'm not taking the money. Now, to what extent is option two a viable option? That depends on how much money is involved. And with respect to this very specific grant, that's not a lot of money. So if you look at 2016, which is the last full budget year, Chicago got roughly $2.3 million under this specific grant. The Chicago overall budget for that year was more than $7.8 billion. So this is less than 0.03% of the budget. So even if Chicago loses this legal battle, which I don't think is particularly likely, but say it does lose it, it in all likelihood will just tell the federal government, fine, I'm not taking the money. It's not such a huge amount of money from my perspective, and I'll continue on doing what I'm doing. And that would probably apply to most cities. For many cities in the U.S., my guess, almost all of them, this is not a major component of their budget, definitely not something for which they're going to sell off what they perceive as their values.
But even though these budgets in these cities can be large, they're often tight. There's not always a lot of wiggle room in budgets. Is this enough that, at least in some places facing a tough budget year, this could be a significant enough amount of money that it changes their behavior?
Look, I mean, it's tough to predict because they'd also have to calculate here political actors' calculations, but it's tough for me to imagine many cities just dropping their sanctuary policies just because of this. Now, if the federal government tries to go after beefier sums of money, that is to say other grants, especially even if they're going after grants that don't actually go to the police, that's a lot of money. And if they're successful at that, then that's a ginormous legal question, whether they'll be successful at that. If they are successful at that, then I think you're totally right, that many cities, including some of the most affluent ones, whether it's in California or New York, will have to rethink their policies.
Would that be a taller constitutional hurdle, though, if the federal government said, I don't know, we're going to cut off your parks restoration funding because of this law enforcement and immigration issue? Would that be easier to challenge in a lawsuit?
It will be easier to challenge in a lawsuit, and that's exactly the lawsuit that's been going on in the Northern District of California for the last few months, a lawsuit brought by the County of Santa Clara, where they argued that the original executive order issued by the president seemed to imply that the federal government will cut all grants to sanctuary cities, and that the Santa Clara, the lawyers there argued, and the court seemed at least sympathetic to the claim by issue because it did issue a stay, that would be unconstitutional because then a lot of these grants the administration just has no discretion in their allocation. They'll have to change statutes, and obviously Congress is not doing that. Other grants, you could just argue that are completely unrelated to policing. So maybe there you will have this issue of, is the federal government actually allowed to condition the granting of money on doing this? So that is totally true, that if they go beyond just the specific grants to policing, they're entering a very, very problematic legal territory.
Nadav,
and that's why, to be fair, they haven't tried to do it yet.
Nadav, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nadav Shoked is an associate professor and expert in local government law at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. He joined us to talk about the city of Chicago's announcement that it's going to sue, it is suing, the Department of Justice for efforts to cut certain federal funding to sanctuary cities. Now, data from the United Nations shows that current conflicts around the world have created the highest number of displaced people ever tallied. More than 20 million people have had to flee their home countries, with about 40 million more people displaced within their nation's borders.
Many scientists have been affected. Thousands of scientists and researchers have had to leave their homes, often leaving a lot of their research behind. These scientists are from places like Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Ethiopia.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about the latest news from the world of science. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Well, we're starting with this, undercovered story in some ways that you talked about in Discover Magazine, these displaced scientists and scholars. What conditions are these scientists facing as they flee their home cities and countries?
Well, you know, it's a tremendous range, both in the experience in their home country and what they where they end up. Our writer in Istanbul talked to researchers from Syria, from Ukraine, from Yemen, and, you know, they fled for a variety of reasons. In some cases, there are universities, their labs were actually bombed. In other cases, they were physically threatened and told, you know, you have a day to leave the country. And these researchers often just either took a flash drive with their data, or in one case, a microbiologist actually just put a bunch of samples of lake water that he was studying in little vials, put them in his suitcase, and left the country. So it's really, it's a range of experiences from a range of different countries. And the big issue is what they're going to. You know, they're not all refugees. Some of them are asylum seekers. Some of them are fortunate enough to have fellowships lined up in other countries that they can go to. But it's really a range, and a lot of them, most of them, are not able to work in their field. So it's frustrating for them, and it's, quite frankly, it's a loss for science in general.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Gemma? Because this isn't just the story of personal setbacks for people. This is a story about a loss of research for science and a loss of knowledge.
Yeah, you know, and even the researchers displaced within their own country, or maybe they're able to stay in their hometown, but they can't go to work because their lab has been bombed. They become very isolated. And then what happens, you know, publish or perish is not just a cliche in research. To be a successful researcher, to have a good career, and also just to advance your field, you have to constantly be in it, and you have to constantly be publishing and be collaborating and be exchanging ideas. And so in addition to not being able to pursue their own research, a lot of these researchers are becoming really isolated and getting so far behind that it's going to be very hard for them to catch up whenever they're able to.
One thing I hadn't thought of is, you know, these are countries that are going to need direct research in restoring conditions. Like you profile in the magazine, a water quality person in, I can't remember if it was Iraq or Syria, but in Yemen, the same thing would be true, where water systems have been disrupted. There's concerns about cholera in Yemen. These are exactly the kinds of researchers you'd want there as the country hopefully soon starts to rebuild.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the researcher you mentioned, his last name is Al-Handal, and he was researching the water at Iraq's Sawa Lake, which has been undergoing years of drought. And that is really affecting what's in the water, the quality of the water, the microscopic organisms in the water. And that affects the overall quality. So it's, you know, it's folks with this kind of firsthand on-the-ground knowledge that just cannot be replaced. And in many ways, he's one of the fortunate researchers in that he is able to, he's in Sweden now, and he's able to work with researchers there to continue some of his own research, but also, you know, some of the Swedish researchers there are saying, we love having him because he has this base of experience that we don't have, and it's contributing and advancing our research on a completely different set of microorganisms. So it's, you know, I think sometimes when we hear stories about displaced persons and refugee seekers, we feel, oh, they're, you know, they're victims, poor, you know, poor person, whatever. But the fact is they have tremendous knowledge, not only within their own field and within their own country, but knowledge that they can impart to other researchers and help other researchers work. So it's a loss in so many ways, but it's really heartening to see a number of organizations springing up with the sole mission of helping these researchers and helping save their science, again, for science overall.
Right, and one of these organizations is called the Scholar Rescue Fund, and there's more than that, but can you tell us about some of these efforts and what they've done so far?
You know, there's an academic peer-reviewed journal called the Journal of Interrupted Studies that is specifically for displaced researchers, and it works to help them even, you know, translate something into English for publication in a journal. There are other groups that are working to live stream and sometimes distribute by DVD all these lectures that not only help the researchers stay current in their research, but really help them stay current in the act of being a researcher. And what I mean by that, for example, there are a lot of predatory journals out there that really are kind of shams, and they'll, you know, really prey on researchers who aren't that skilled in picking them out. Well, there are now seminars that are live streamed or, again, distributed by DVD, where researchers who have become isolated can learn how to make sure their research is published in a good journal, in a peer-reviewed journal. So there are all kinds of things that, you know, I never even thought of until I read this story as I was editing it, and I thought, wow, yeah, you do need to know about that. You do need to keep up with that. Others are helping arrange fellowships for researchers. And even, you know, if you have a researcher who has an incredible skill and has been educated in Syria, say, and then they move to France, they have to get all their credentials translated into the French system and accepted by the French government. But what if all their credentials were sitting in a lab that was destroyed? How do they prove that they actually do have a PhD? Those are all issues that these organizations are helping displaced researchers deal with.
Gemma Tarlak is with us from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Moving to another story, Gemma, we're always looking for new tools to understand our prehistory, evolution of humans and other species. People point to DNA a lot, but now ancient proteins may be opening some new doors. Paleoproteomics is the field. How does that work?
Yeah, and this is a really fascinating field that it's just emerging. It's kind of where ancient DNA studies were in the 90s. You know, they're just getting their ducks in a row, so to speak, and tons of information because, you know, DNA has a wealth of information, but it's very much prone to degrading over time and getting contaminated with microbes, whereas ancient proteins are a little more sturdy. And the really neat thing is, if I took a liver cell from you and a brain cell from you, and I looked at the DNA in both those cells, the DNA would be identical, but the cells themselves would appear very different, and that's because they're composed of different proteins. Proteins are kind of, you know, the workhorses of the body. And so by looking at ancient proteins in an animal, we are able to tell a little bit about how that animal lived. Was it cold-blooded? Was it warm-blooded? Was it a fast runner or more of, you know, an ambush hunter? There are all these different things you can tell by the kinds of proteins that you find in a fossil or as residue on an artifact.
So is this kind of work with proteins, is it going to overtake what we've been doing so far with DNA? It's a little more recent. Does it have the potential to string more of the picture together for us?
Well, I think they really complement each other because there are some things that DNA can tell you that proteins can't. So DNA is much better at establishing relationships between species, between individual organisms. But proteins are much better at telling you a little bit about how those organisms lived, what kind of environment they were operating in, and again, kind of what kind of structure, what kind of lifestyle they had. So they really complement each other. The great thing is ancient proteins do live a lot longer. You know, earlier this year, researchers announced that they think they found ancient proteins in a dinosaur fossil that's 195 million years old. So you will never find DNA that old. In fact, the upper limit, absolute upper limit for DNA, they think is 1 million years, and that's under ideal circumstances. So ancient proteins can really fill in some of the gaps that DNA is just going to inevitably leave.
Finally, Gemma, summer is driving season. Driving means traffic, and you wrote a piece yourself, 20 Things to Know About Traffic. What kind of stuff did you learn as you started to dig into the science behind traffic?
Well, I think my favorite thing I learned researching this, you know, I was reading a lot by William Phelps Eno, who was a pioneer of vehicular traffic control in the early 20th century. And, you know, some things never change. He wrote in one of his early books that, quote, "I don't think I ever went on the streets of New York nor of any other city or town without being astonished at the stupidity of drivers, pedestrians, and police." So, you know, I think assuming that you're an above-average driver goes way back. But there's a lot of fascinating stuff about traffic, including molecular traffic. Our DNA, there's actually the enzymes that repair our DNA have a traffic flow that they stick to way better than we do to prevent collisions. So there's just, you know, traffic, it goes all the way from the nanoscale all the way up. And it's really, it's a part of life whether you like it or not.
And Gemma, as we start to wrap up, there's a lot of stuff about how traffic and roads affect wildlife. What did you find there?
Yeah, one of the things I thought was really interesting was that the roads with the highest risk of a wildlife vehicle collision are actually roads with high visibility. It seems counterintuitive, but roads that are kind of straight and with wider lanes and shoulders, they have a higher risk. And the thought behind that is that high visibility may give you a false sense of security, and drivers go faster, and speed is, of course, a known crash risk.
We'll leave it there. Gemma, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks. Drive safe, everyone.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the coolest news from the world of science. Now, on the first Monday of each month, WPR director Mike Crane or director of content Mike Arnold join Joy Cardine or us here on Central Time to share info about WPR and answer your questions.
And we want to hear from you right now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about programming or news coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio? What do you want to hear more of or less of on WPR? And what do you want to know about WPR's budget or financial operations? And, of course, with her retirement this week, what are your favorite memories of Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Chief Operating Officer Mike Arnold is in the studio with us right now. Mike, thanks for coming back.
Yeah, great to be here.
Well, I don't want to bury the lead. We mentioned just now Kathleen Dunn.
Yeah.
This is big.
That's a pretty big
Yeah,
job.
Retiring.
Yeah, it is. She's retiring after 24 years on Wisconsin Public Radio and a 44-year career in radio. She announced her retirement, and her last day on the air is going to be this Thursday. So it's coming up
quick.
Soon.
It really
You better
quick.
Listen while you can. She's really a huge part of the Ideas Network since the very beginning, or nearly the beginning, at least. She's conducted more than 10,000 interviews.
Wow.
And she's had conversations with people like Maya Angelou, Ken Burns, Studs Terkel. In 2014, she was inducted to the Milwaukee Media Hall of Fame. And her voice is just one of those regular voices you hear all the time. So it's really going to be sad to say goodbye to Kathleen Dunn. But she's got exciting plans for the future, and we're looking forward to giving her a good going-away party on Thursday.
There are dog toys accumulating in the lobby as we speak for Kathleen. We know people who listen, you know she loves dogs. She loves presidential history. She loves politics. And those subjects will continue, but of course we're going to miss Kathleen. And Mike, looking forward, getting over our sadness, what do we have to not take her place, but what will be on the air at that time?
Yeah, starting a week from today, from 1 to 3 on Monday through Thursday, we'll hear a show called 1A. When you normally hear the Kathleen Dunn Show. 1A is a program hosted by Joshua Johnson. And if that name sounds familiar, it's probably because you may remember a limited series that he did the summer before this. So I guess last summer, he did a thing called Truth Be Told. And he was based in San Francisco at that time. But now he's in Washington, D.C., and it's a new show, and it's been doing very well. He replaced a longtime program called The Diane Rehm Show that was very popular with public radio listeners, and people really enjoy this program. And we've actually heard some people say, boy, you really should pick that up. So we're going to give it a try from 1 to 3 on Monday through Thursday. Don't worry, though. Science Friday will still be heard on Fridays from 1 to 3.
Let's give a listen to 1A host Joshua Johnson. In this piece, he's talking about the $15 minimum wage in Seattle.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Aspen Public Radio in Colorado. Seattle was one of the first major cities to mandate an hourly minimum wage of $15. A new minimum wage increase will go into effect on July 1st in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and a couple of states. Other cities and states are considering similar increases. This week, a study showed that Seattle's increase could be hurting low-wage workers. Minimum wage opponents were gleeful. Others were skeptical of the study's methodology.
So that's Joshua Green in the new show 1A, which is coming to Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's take a caller now. We've got Stella on the line with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I have a question about, I've been hearing the announcements for this 1A replacing Kathleen Dunn's show. First of all, is it a call-in show?
It is a call-in show, yeah. They do have some call-in components on that program.
Okay.
Yeah.
My experience, I love On Point, and there have been quite a number of times when I would have liked to have commented, you know, phoned in a comment, and I can be on the phone and do redial and redial and redial and redial, and I never have gotten through to On Point. And with Kathleen Dunn, with the local programs, with Kathleen Dunn and with Larry Mueller, the local phone numbers, either the Milwaukee or the Madison phone numbers, with persistence, generally, I can get through. But I've never gotten through to On Point, and it sounds like this is going to be another program that is produced, not produced by WPR, not broadcast, and with a local call-in number. And are we ever going to be able to get through?
Stella, thanks for that. Mike, what do you think?
One of the things that they've said is that they're very excited about being on the air in Wisconsin. They have a lot of respect for the Ideas Network, and they're trying to think of some ways that they might be able to incorporate people from Wisconsin as part of the show. It's been really interesting to hear how excited they are to be on the Ideas Network. We may not realize it being in Wisconsin, but there are a lot of people who have a whole lot of respect for it, and I know that they're very excited about being on. So hopefully we'll be able to hear that. But I do understand your point, Stella, that sometimes it's a little harder to get in if you're trying to call a show that's national and has, you know, they only have so many lines and they can take so many calls. So we'll definitely keep that in mind as we listen to 1A.
And yeah, I do from time to time catch Wisconsin callers on Point. So
yeah,
hopefully the
yeah.
same will be true with mm-hmm. Joshua Johnson. But it sounds like a good fit. He talks to people about stuff, which is what we do here on the Ideas Network. I'm going to have a business card made.
Yeah, he's very interested. The show is very interested in providing different perspectives, not just political perspectives, but perspectives from different parts of the country as well. And so I think you'll be impressed by what it sounds like. But we'll give that a try starting on Monday.
And Mike, there's also some evening schedule changes that are going to be happening here on the Ideas Network. Tell us a little bit about what's going to change.
Yeah, we're moving some things around a little bit. As It Happens is going to be heard at 7 o'clock. And the benefit of hearing As It Happens at 7 is that it's a little closer to the time when they actually produce the show. So the news should be pretty up to date at that time. Then after that, at 8 o'clock, we have Q. At 9, we'll be doing a new program on Monday through Thursday called Newsday from the BBC. It's a new program that they developed, and it's designed to give a global perspective on the news. You'll hear that Monday through Thursdays at 9 at night. And then we also are going to be doing some reshuffling during the 10 o'clock hour on weeknights. On Mondays, you'll hear Reveal, the documentary series that we air. On Tuesdays, you'll hear Latino USA. Wednesdays and Thursdays, you'll hear To the Best of Our Knowledge, which is produced here in Wisconsin. And on Friday nights, we'll have a storytelling block. It'll start with The Moth at 9 o'clock on Friday, and then it's followed by Snap Judgment at 10. A lot of people enjoy hearing those two shows together. Now, I will note that we have a couple shows that are going off the schedule. Dinner Party Download is leaving the schedule, and Political Junkie with Ken Rudin is leaving the schedule as well. And one of the reasons that Political Junkie is moving is that there's so many political discussions going on right now in a lot of our other shows that we thought it made sense to have that show go away for a little while.
Now, Mike, with any change like all these changes going on, I think I can guarantee some people are going to love any individual change, and some yeah. people are going to hate in the individual chase. Well, what's some of the thinking that goes into making these kind of changes, especially in that evening schedule?
Well, I mean, we're, one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to have a more consistent schedule from day to day. We've had some people who say at 7 o'clock, one night it's one thing, the other night it's another thing. So by having as it happens on every night, I think that'll allow people to develop more of a habit for listening. Another thing is there is a lot of news going on right now. So both as it happens and also Newsday from the BBC are very focused on what's happening in the news. The BBC program is live from London every day. So that'll allow us to get updates on what's happening in the world around us. We also know that there are a lot of people who really enjoy hearing perspectives from the BBC, and some people had said it'd be nice to hear it a little earlier in the evening. So that's the thinking behind that.
And we got another caller here we want to take. Paul is joining us in Door County. Paul, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make, I listen to Josh Johnson quite a bit since he replaced Kathleen Bell. It's a great show. But in regards to questions on call-ins, they do take call-ins, but you leave a voicemail with your comment or question, and they will respond to those that they think warrant response to. I find that better because you don't get a lot of calls that probably shouldn't have been.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, and that is one element of the show that they developed to make it, they just want to make sure they put the best calls on the air, so that's why they do that. So, Paul, I appreciate your thoughts on that. And it's good to hear that you enjoy the show.
And we're talking right now with WPR's Associate Director and Director of Content, Mike Arnold, for this edition of Mondays with Mike on Central Time.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you love about WPR? What would you like to see change? Do you have questions about programming on Wisconsin Public Radio, either network, Ideas Network, or the NPR News and Classical Music Network, if you also listen to that one? What keeps you listening? How could we serve you better as radio networks? And do you have a favorite Kathleen Dunn memory you'd like to share as she signs off from the Ideas Network later this week? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation right now with WPR's Chief Operating Officer, Mike Arnold. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions or comments do you have for Mike about WPR's programming? What keeps you a loyal listener? And what can we do on our end here to make the experience even better for you? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And before we go back to our callers, Mike, a special from Wisconsin Life coming up, World War I commemorations. We're marking the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entering that conflict. What are we going to see from Wisconsin Life?
Yeah, we're doing a series on World War I called Wisconsin in the First World War that will be focusing in on that. And it'll be really interesting. You'll hear it on the air, but you can also find out more about it on the Wisconsin Life website. It's wisconsinlife.org/series/Wisconsin First World War. Definitely worth listening to. There's a lot of stories to be told about Wisconsin during the First World War.
All right, another call here for you, Mike. This is Lori joining us in Madison. Lori, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I would like to see one of the Central Time repeats replaced with either Fresh Air or On Point, but I would like to hear both of those shows during, you know, the late commute drive time between 4 and 6.
Okay.
All right, Lori, thank you for that. I've been following this debate actually on our Facebook page, Michael. Some people saying they like the repeat because they can't catch it earlier. They're busy, they're driving, they're running errands. Some people saying, I don't want it to repeat again.
Well, it sounds like that's what Lori is saying.
I think that's what Lori is saying.
Yeah, I think we always try to strike a balance. I mean, one of the things that we find is that a lot of people do appreciate hearing Central Time on the way home because it covers a lot of issues that keep you up to date on what's happening. And it has been working from an audience perspective in a lot of ways. But Lori, we'll definitely keep your thoughts in mind as we think about things in the future.
Yeah, I sometimes listen to Central Time on my drive home. It's pretty good, except for this loudmouth fella who's on all the time. If you can get him to pipe down a little. Oh, no, wait. Oh, my God. That's been me all along. Oh, no. Thanks a lot for the call, Lori. We'll go next to Peter on the line in Stoughton. Peter, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering who your focused audience is for Ask Me Another. It somehow occurs to me that a radio show about pop culture trivia doesn't really fit in with what Wisconsin Public Radio typically tries to do. I listen to the show, and yeah, it's kind of funny and kind of interesting, but I really don't care about some television program that I never watched in 1988, let alone now. Or you took it off the air for maybe a week or two, a month or so back, and I thought, great, it's gone.
Peter, thanks.
So close and yet so far. Yeah, I mean, Peter, it's definitely one of those shows that people seem to either love or hate. We do think that there's a place for entertainment programs on public radio, particularly on the weekend. You think about a show like Car Talk, for example.
People
like that okay. It's not about pop culture. It's about cars, but it's not always about cars. And so there's always kind of a balance in public radio, and Ask Me Another is a program that is trying to be entertaining on the weekends, but in a smart way, as much as they can. Interestingly, we do have some people who feel like you, Peter, and they're wishing for it to go away. And then there are a lot of people who really enjoy it. You'd be surprised at how many people enjoy listening to Ask Me Another on a weekly basis, and it is actually doing well. It's building an audience for that program on Saturday mornings. But it's always something that we, you know, we try to balance those things. We try to have some fun, and we also try to have some serious conversations, too. And Ask Me Another is a little bit more on the fun side. And for some people, it's not fun at all. But I think, you know, Lori, when she called earlier, she mentioned Fresh Air, which is a show that's on public radio and deals with pop culture quite a bit. And it's very well received by people. But Ask Me Another is a little bit less serious, I think, than Fresh Air. So thanks for that call, Peter. And we are keeping an eye on our weekend schedule. So you never know. Maybe it will go away someday for good.
You know, the question makes me kind of curious, Mike. Do, you know, public radio as a whole is something that exists across the country, but do you think that individual networks like ours maybe have their own character, their own personality? What might work in Iowa doesn't work always in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, I've before I came here, I worked at a lot of other places, and there were a lot of people who suggested that that there were different tastes in places. Probably the most notable, I was the program director in New Orleans for a while, and we put Car Talk on. We were the last major market station to put Car Talk on, and some people in New Orleans felt like New Orleans was not a Car Talk kind of town, and oddly enough, that show was the most successful program on the station shortly after we put it on the air. So sometimes tastes sort of bridge across different communities, but there are times when it's different. So, I mean, we're always keeping an eye on things, and we'll definitely keep Peter's thoughts in mind as we plan future schedule changes.
Talking to Mike Arnold, Chief Operating Officer here at WPR. It is Mondays with Mike. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Actually, a Facebook comment, Kathleen Dunn, retiring. Chris on Facebook says, yay to Kathleen. Her retirement should be an inspiration to everybody. A new puppy, a new inspiration, and I believe with all the talent you have there, you will fill that position. So, Chris, thanks a lot for that. We'll go now to Gary on the line in Glendale. Gary, hi.
Good afternoon. I was speaking of Kathleen Dunn. I was wondering what is the fate future of the Milwaukee studio, which I know is expensive, now that Kathleen is retiring.
I think the future of the Milwaukee studio is pretty bright. We've actually expanded our news reporting there, and probably will be doing some other things in Milwaukee. So I think there's a bright future ahead. Our assistant news director is based there, Kyla Calvert-Mason. We're probably we have more reporters there than we used to, and probably will continue to do that. So I think Milwaukee is going to continue to be an important studio for us here at WPR.
Well, Gary, thanks a lot for that call, and we're going to go next to Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, I think I was talking to your operator when I called in about the
our producer,
caller,
Amanda.
Producer, I was just wondering, as a person who reads a lot but does listen a lot to your show, especially for the news on NPR, what I was wondering about more of a commentary on the pop culture for, like, Game of Thrones or what's going on in the video. Now that there are so many options for entertainment, it's almost like you feel out of it unless you're not watching.
Yeah.
You spend 20 hours of TV a day.
Well, Charlie, in a sense, you've come to the right place. Got a couple of super fans for Game of Thrones here, and I don't know why we haven't talked about it more on the show yet.
We've done some, and we talked to a TV critic who kind of brought us up to date on some of the big stuff and that fear of missing out and try to figure out how a TV critic could possibly stay on top of all the shows that are out there. But it's something we don't do that often, and we could maybe do more of. But Mike, a more network-wide, maybe a little more attention to pop culture in the form of TV.
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, that is definitely a role that we could play, is to provide a guide in the world of peak TV that we're living in right now, I suppose. Although, I think as Peter mentioned earlier, I think it's something we always want to balance. You know, we don't want to just be talking about, pop culture and TV and stuff like that. But there definitely could be a place for somebody to help guide people so that they don't wind up watching too much TV that's bad.
Well, Charlie, we're going to put that in the kitty. I think we could probably at least make a Game of Thrones segment happen for you. And Mike, I want to ask you, we're a little over halfway through WPR Centennial Year, and there's more stuff coming up to get excited about. What
we,
is there?
We do. We have another old-time radio drama performance. This one is on August 12th, coming up this weekend at Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield. And then on October 14th, we're having this huge show and fundraiser thing at Overture Center in Madison. And Ari Shapiro from NPR's All Things Considered is going to be the MC for the night. It should be a lot of fun. There's a lot of different things happening in the show, including an interesting sing-along segment at one point. So I think it'll be entertaining, to say the least. But that's coming up on the 14th at the Overture Center in Madison. You can go to our Centennial website and get tickets for that if you want, and also read some interesting stories from our 100-year history by going to wpr.org/100. You can write that, or you can put the numbers in there.
Oh, okay.
It works both
That's
ways.
Convenient. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good listener
it's
service.
Amazing.
Have we been getting a lot of good response to our 100-year celebration?
We have, yeah. We've had a lot of people come out and celebrate. It's been a lot of fun, and I think these last two events are going to be great.
So, Mike, looking back again, let's and where we began with the retirement of Kathleen Dunn, are there moments that you think back on or that you heard listeners talk to you about over the years that you think these are some moments we remember pretty well and they stick out?
Well, when somebody does 10,000 interviews, it's kind of hard to pick which one is
right.
The best one.
I know, I put you on the spot.
But, I mean, I do think some of the big names are definitely memorable, but I think one of the things that's great about Kathleen is it doesn't matter what topic she's taking. She approaches it with a sort of a personal nature that really engages people, and I think that's something we're going to miss quite a bit. Fortunately for us, as, you know, I think was mentioned in one of the comments earlier, we have a lot of people who want to carry on that tradition. So Kathleen Dunn will live on for many years here at Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks to the role she's played as a key host and somebody who has really set the standard for what the Ideas Network should be.
Great place to leave it. Mike, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And you can continue to share your thoughts and your questions over on the Central Time Facebook page or on the Wisconsin Public Radio Facebook page, for that matter, and check in on future appearances by either of the mics. And, of course, follow WPR.org when that new schedule hits the networks. Milwaukee is getting some national attention today for some of the biggest food challenges in the country.
That's right. Three of the city's restaurants are going to be highlighted in the premiere of the Travel Channel's newly revived show, Man vs. Food, where the host, Casey Adams, eats some of the biggest or spiciest or otherwise really hard to eat foods in American restaurants.
The challenges in tonight's show include the Commish, a massive sandwich at Jake's Deli that is a corned beef and pastrami sandwich weighing in at about 4 pounds.
The sandwich is named for Milwaukee's Bud Selig, former commissioner of Major League Baseball. Selig joins the host, Casey Adams, in this preview.
I'm about to take on the Commish Challenge.
Are you the one doing that? I just saw the sandwich. It makes me nervous looking at it.
Do you think I could finish it?
I don't see how any human being could finish it, but we're going to find out at 3 o'clock, aren't we?
Other challenges include a massive pork shank at Mader's restaurant and at Sobelman's, a pitcher-sized Bloody Mary, which includes, as part of the garnish, a complete fried chicken.
And Rob, I'm guessing of those three, you would pick the Bloody Mary and the complete fried chicken.
I don't like Bloody Marys in any volume. I don't like tomato juice. It kills the Bloody Mary for me.
Pork shank. You got a pork shank here.
Four pounds of pastrami and corn. I think I'm gonna sit all of these challenges out, if you can believe
it. Let's just watch the show. How about
that? Or maybe not. I don't know if I can even watch somebody else eat those.
I'm glad that Milwaukee is famous for its massive food, though.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.